Hi, I'm Malak Fouad, and welcome back to What I Did Next from A&T Media, a show where we explore life's pivot points. This episode is brought to you by Merakez, Building Spaces for Life. Merakez is the leading mixed-use developer in Egypt, with an ever-growing portfolio of commercial and residential projects. Visit www.merakez.net for more information. This episode marks the end of Season 1. Before we get started, I want to thank you for joining me for this inaugural season and to thank all of you who left such wonderful reviews in the different podcast players and on Instagram. Today's episode is slightly different in that there is no guest. Instead, my producer, Chirag Desai, is turning the tables on me and putting me in the hot seat. He'll be asking me about my own life journey and, of course, the season's two staple questions.
Well, hello.
Hi, Chirag.
Welcome to Turning the Tables.
It's kind of strange. It's just weird that I'm not the one asking the questions.
So let's talk about your dinner party.
So I have a very eclectic mix.
Okay, that's great.
So my first choice would be Paul Simon, the singer and songwriter. I listen to him a lot as a solo artist and when he was with Simon and Garfunkel. I love his South African period. I love his, his 60s period. I mean, there's a lot of really different types of output with him. And I wonder what kind of a dinner party guest he'd be. I think he'd be quite interesting and a slightly off-center kind of contributor.
Right. That sounds fun. Okay.
Then my all-time favorite artist, painter, is Picasso.
Okay.
And I would love to have him at the table because, first of all, he lived at a really interesting period. And he became very famous, I guess really famous, with the Spanish Civil War, with his Guernica piece. But he'd been living in France before that, and he was part of a very sort of avant-garde group of artists. And then, of course, he became very much more famous after World War II and became the sort of, I guess, in a way, the first celebrity painter.
Yeah.
Maybe one of the first painters as well to become a rich man in his lifetime, which is, at the time, I think was quite unusual.
Correct. Yeah. They're getting recognition at or during their lifetimes, right? Yeah.
Exactly. And he's had, of course, he had a very interesting private life. So he went through mistresses. Like water. He had kids all over the place.
Right.
And, you know, just a really interesting life and a lifestyle. So I'd be really interested to meet him. And then my next guest would be someone very controversial in the Middle East, somebody who I think would generate vehement hate from most people. But I find really interesting because I studied him. So I would want to have Henry Kissinger at the table. but I look at him more in a big picture way, in the sense that he was so strategic in formulating American foreign policy over the last 70 years. And he's still alive. He's nearly, I think he's nearly 100.
Yeah, and I mean, from many accounts, it is continued to be said, right, that his influence on American foreign policy continues to this day, even if he's not active.
Absolutely. And up to Obama. Obama consulted him, for several things. And I just find him really interesting because he's a person who was a refugee from Germany to the U.S. as a child. He went back to Germany as a U.S. Army officer, then went back to the States and graduated from Harvard and then went into public service. And he's very controversial. And I kind of like that, actually. I like the fact that he's not, he would make a very good dinner party guest because no good dinner party is complete without a good debate, in my book.
Yeah.
And for me, the best dinners are always the ones where you're there until 2 a.m. arguing with someone about some the finer points of, you know, the Vietnam policy or whatever.
Sure.
So he would be the perfect person for that.
Yeah, and I think there's a little bit of a difference between, you know, Henry Kissinger as a personality and his influence and what impact it might have had on the life in this part of the world, versus him being a dinner party guest and being an interesting personality to understand how he thinks and how he views, yeah. You know, events and things that happen. I think that that's the distinction, perhaps, that which you like to see on the table, at least.
Right, exactly.
All right, who's next?
The next choice is a very personal choice. So I would have my my aunt.
Okay.
My aunt Nadia, who is my mother's sister. She passed away in 2003. In the UN bombing in Iraq. So that was the first bombing of the post-Iraq invasion, or the post-US invasion of Iraq. She was part of the UN mission there, and she was one of 22 people who passed away. She was the chief of staff of the head of mission there.
Okay.
And she was a lifelong UN career person. She's a huge role model for me and always has been. She was a very, very interesting woman. She was tons of fun. She was very irreverent. She met all the heads of state, going through the UN halls. She'd treat Bill Clinton as she would treat the janitor at the UN. So everyone was equal in her books, and right. Everyone had something to contribute. And she was just, a larger than life character. And, you know, they always say the good die young. And in her case, that was definitely the situation in my books. Plus, she could tell the best stories ever. So as a dinner party guest, she'd be probably, you know, in command of the entire table.
A table that sits Henry Kissinger, which is interesting.
Isn't it? Yeah. Oh, she'd give him a run for his money. Absolutely. And he'd be charmed by her. Okay. And she'd have him, like, you know, eating out of her hand by the end of the dinner. And, you know, she's hugely missed. We've done a fund, an educational fund in her name at AUC in Cairo here. Right. So every year we have a guest speaker from the world of current affairs that comes and gives a talk. It's a very important part of the AUC calendar. And it, for us, it's a very important way to keep her memory alive, trying to get young people excited about public service.
And now a nice legacy as well. Yeah.
Very much so, very much so. So I'd also have her parents at the table. So my maternal grandparents.
Right.
I was extremely lucky that I had them in my life until I was about 30. And I was extremely close to them. My grandfather was what they call a bon vivant. So he would, you know, he'd grab everyone, he'd take them out for dinner. We'd have a fantastic time, and it didn't matter who was there. He would just include everyone. They led a very interesting life, my grandparents. They were part of the royal court in Egypt prior to the 1952 revolution. So they were very involved. My grandfather was a chamberlain to the king.
Okay.
So he was privy to all the sort of the goings on at the palace. They got married at the beginning of World War II, and they worked throughout the 40s at the palace, both of them. My grandmother was a lady-in-waiting to the queen. So they have this perspective, and, you know, whenever I was around them, I'd always try and get stories out of them. And to their credit, they took those stories to the grave.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. They never divulged. They didn't gossip. They didn't want to talk about what happened there, but they knew everything. And then after the revolution of 52, my grandfather particularly was very, avant-garde in his thinking. So he, you know, having been of the old ancien regime, if you like, felt that there was not much of a future for his children in Egypt at the time. So in the 60s, he encouraged all his children, his three children, to leave Egypt and make their lives abroad. And it was quite unusual for a man of my grandfather's generation to say, you know what, you guys need to leave. You can't, right. There's nothing here for you. And even though they did that, we remained a very, very close-knit family, even though everyone was all over the place. And that's a testament to both my grandfather and my grandmother, that they nurtured that family dynamic.
Well, so it's really interesting, right? Because especially when you talk about your grandparents, because I think one of the things that I've been thinking about, because we keep listening to the dinner party question from different guests.
Yeah.
But if, like, the same thing, like, if someone were to ask me, like, I would be like, can I go, like, two or three generations up in my family and pick someone from there? Someone that I couldn't, I don't have an overlap with, because I couldn't, and just really understand what that time was like, of course.
But hearing the different perspectives from different generations, I think, is priceless, you know?
Yeah, I think I think this is something I think I've come around to in the last few years, but I think we disproportionately discredit, which is a terrible use of phrase, but the previous generations in kind of them like being like, oh, they were really traditional and we're modern now, and oh, they were X and we are Y now. They may not have driven cars, and that's fine. Or they may not have had phones, and that's fine. But a lot of them were very open in their thinking. They were massive thinkers in those years. You know, their ideas of philosophy and people and societies and stuff actually were very deep. It wasn't superficial at all.
I also think that that's a sign of age, Chirag. You're showing probably. Your age.
No, probably.
If you were in your early 20s or even earlier, you'd be like, no, I have nothing to learn from
course.
Them.
No, 100%.
You know,
I'm with
but
you on
with
that,
time, yeah. You kind of begin to appreciate it, you know?
Okay, well, we're quickly going to move on from here before we start going to my age, aren't we? I have a quick follow-up before we move on, though. I'm curious. When you were building your list today, how much of, not so much the guests themselves, but the way they put their tables together, like, did that factor in when you were thinking about, like, oh, yeah, like, I should think about the music and I should think about the light and the intensity?
That's a really great question. Actually, what surprised me when we had originally formulated the question when we were beginning season one, was that what the guests were hung up about was the fact that the guests didn't match each other.
They had to make a good dinner table.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When I was framing the original question, I just thought, who do I want to talk to? I wasn't thinking, oh, well, so-and-so like so-and-so, like you would in a normal dinner party.
Right.
And so I found that a couple of the people were a bit preoccupied with that. But on the whole, for me, and I think for most of the guests on the show, they just put a list of people they wanted to meet, or a lot of them put family members as well, Chirag, if you remember.
Yeah.
So that did influence me, actually.
The Steve Jobs speech, which is something that you've referenced many times, talks about connecting the dots, and that became a baseline for you. You know, someone that is very interested in talking to people, I'm talking about myself here as well, but I know that's that applies to you too. It's very interesting to kind of like pick out these certain things as opposed to just, you know, just say like, okay, start here, where were you born and what did you do next, you know?
I think clearly, I mean, we'll go into this in a bit, but I've had some major pivots in my life. And I think that obviously subconsciously played a big part in this. The Steve Jobs speech I had listened to many, many years ago, and I absolutely adored it, and it did remain with me. And it made me think, yes, you know, one thing does lead to another, whether you are conscious of it or not.
Right.
So I think it was a combination of things just coming together. I think we were also, I was very lucky as well in that this process for this particular podcast started last August.
Right.
That's when we began fleshing this out as an idea. And so we had, I mean, I had the luxury, or I gave myself the luxury of time. You and I were back and forth a lot from August all the way through to November, really like devising what this should be. And obviously you have a lot of experience in doing this, and you asked some very important questions. And, you know, we went through a process of elimination and drilling down on certain ideas. And, you know, it was a really useful way to create this.
So let's talk about your pivot points. Let's start with the first one.
So I'm somebody who I'm fully Egyptian, but I've only been living in Egypt for the last 19 years. I was born in the States, and I then lived in Saudi Arabia. So my first pivot came at the age of 12 when I went to boarding school. And I moved to England, and it was actually one of the best things that could have ever happened to me, because at the time, of course, I was miserable. I spent 3 months, you know, crying myself to sleep. But, you know, right after that, I made my best friends. And it was extremely formative, because not only was the concept of boarding school, it suited me. It's not for everybody, but it suited me and it suited my character. I think that those years between 12 and 17 are, you're like a sponge, you know, you take in everything around you.
Absolutely.
Very formative. So that was a major, major pivot for me. And I, you know, I'd always been coming back and forth to Egypt all my life because I had a lot of family here. And after university, so during university, I did a lot of internships. As I mentioned earlier, I interned at the UN in New York for two summers. And then I also interned at Condé Nast, which is the holding company for a lot of the big glossy magazines like Vogue and Vanity Fair and so on.
Condé Nast Traveler. And
exactly. And I loved that world. I liked journalism. But I realized that for me, I wanted to do something a bit more serious in terms of the content. After university, I decided to come to Egypt almost like a gap year and see what living here would be like. And so I moved here and I worked at the Ahram newspaper. And I loved the job, but unfortunately, I didn't like living in Cairo at all. So I went back to the UK and eventually found work as a journalist there. And then I found myself becoming a little bit pigeonholed into the sort of fluffy writing features that were of not real interest. And I was working at the time at the Daily Mail newspaper, which is extremely cutthroat, but not at all the kind of work I wanted to do. I actually left journalism completely and worked for a media consulting company that was an American company.
Right.
And at the time, we did a lot of work with the internet industry, which was just kind of booming at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
This is like 99.
Right.
So that was kind of fun. But then the industry went bust, right? So there was a crash, the dot-com crash. And the U.S. company closed down our office because we were the international arm of it.
Right, that goes first, yeah.
And here again is my next major pivot. I found myself at a loss. What should I do? And I decided I would take an extended break. And I decided, okay, I'm going to go to Cairo. And I remember very clearly September 11 was a turning point because I remember thinking the whole world is going to change now. And there's going to be a reconfiguration and a recalibration of how we are perceived. And yet I'm an American citizen, having grown up in the UK, but I still felt that there was this shift that was going to happen.
Oh.
And I made the decision that I, even though it was a subconscious thing, I had a return ticket in my drawer. And the date on the ticket was 20th of January, 2002. And I found the ticket the following summer, which now you know me a little bit, Chirag. I'm a very organized person.
Right.
And I don't make these kind of mistakes.
Right. The ticket would not have just been sitting there. I can
that's
completely
just,
see
yeah,
that.
You know, that's yeah. just, exactly. Yeah, that's totally. Just, that doesn't happen in my book, you know. And I just completely forgot about it. So there you have it. So I guess it was meant to be.
You know, you mentioned initially the first time when you came to Cairo and you tried to work there and you didn't enjoy the environment and you didn't really enjoy it. What changed this time?
I think first of all, I had a lot of friends in Cairo at the time.
Right.
Which always makes I got a job fairly quickly that I was enjoying.
Okay.
And he'll be very glad to hear this. I met my husband. So.
Okay.
Who you have met as well.
Right.
So he'll be very happy to hear that he was very part of the, very much part of that pivot.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I can see that. I mean, that makes sense. And I know I did it too with my life, is I you discredit the ability of the social circle. And that includes relationships and family and everything else. But the more people that I tend to see, you know, actually tend to have that pull and tend to have those ties. And in fact, those ties make or break where they live eventually.
I think, you know, people like you and me, you've got family in India, you know, you're always going to have a pull to where you're originally from. And I think
that's
that's a good thing, you know. I mean, it adds layers to your character, you know. So now I'm based in Egypt. I've been here 19 years.
So you never left after that pivot, basically?
No, I never left. I'm not going to lie. It hasn't all been hunky-dory.
Of course.
There have been a lot of highs and a lot of lows. But it's home now, you know, my parents are now here as well.
Okay.
I have a family, you know, this is it. The revolution was a major, major factor though in changing, my kind of perspective on the country. But that's another conversation.
I'm sure we could do an entire, a couple of episodes probably.
Yeah, we could do a show on that. So my next pivot is not a nice pivot. So I have two beautiful boys. When the second one was born, I was 7 weeks later, I was diagnosed with cancer. It's obviously a while ago now. It's 14 years and I'm in remission and I'm fine. But, you know, I was 34 at the time. And, you know, obviously I was sick while I was pregnant and I didn't realize.
Right.
And it's an extremely strange thing for a healthy pregnant woman to suddenly have a baby and then be diagnosed 7 weeks later. I had Hodgkin's lymphoma. And I was lucky that I had the baby in the UK. And I then went into a 6-month chemotherapy course. And, you know, I was lucky enough that the entire family moved with me. And, you know, but it was it probably was the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life. And I don't think anything else after this will ever feel as challenging or as hard.
Yeah, and I was going to say, actually, like, you're probably one of those massive pivot points in anyone's life, and then especially in a mother's life, I think, you know, the euphoria of having, you know, having a child, like, is not something you could even look, like, even consider or enjoy or experience really well, right, if that was the case.
It was hard. I mean, it was very difficult. And luckily, my son, Taymour, is probably the most gregarious and outgoing and happy boy. But, you know, and then following from that, so, you know, after something like that, you kind of, you know, come back to what you think is normal life, and everyone kind of just expects you to get on with things and, oh, well, you're back now, you're fine now, okay, let's go back to normal. And actually, no, there's no such thing as back to normal. It changes you in such fundamental ways that you're really never the same. You know, I was extremely carefree beforehand. And now I'm, you know, I then became very fearful about lots of things. You know, I worried about the children incessantly, and I feared for them and all of that kind of thing. Of course, now with time, that recedes, becomes less magnified. But there were a couple of years where, you know, That was hard. It was difficult.
I mean, you mentioned now you feel with time it's receded. Do you feel like it's is that just you're getting better at dealing with it, or is it just perspective has changed how you view the same things?
I think it's both. When I got back to Cairo after my treatment, I went to see a therapist because there was no one around me who could understand it, and I didn't want to burden my husband or my parents. They'd been through enough with me. And it, you know, it wasn't their department. I needed to see a professional.
Right.
And she was amazing, and she helped me through a lot. And then it all came tumbling down again when the revolution hit.
Right.
Because, you know, you sort of go along, you coast along, and you think you're fine, and then it just takes one hair trigger thing to knock you off center again.
This wasn't a hair trigger as well, right? It was a massive event. Yeah.
It was a massive disruption to our life. You know, I'm always amazed when I look back on all these things. You know, I feel sometimes like a 90-year-old woman who's had all these experiences condensed into literally the space of 5 years. And it's when I think of it in that way, I feel very old. But then I also think, you know what? The mind is so resilient, and we forget, and, you know, you forget pain and you just get on with it. You know, you can't let it get to you, because if you do, you'll never get out of bed in the morning. You, as a mother to those two young boys, that was never an option.
Yeah, you have to be present, right? You cannot.
Yeah. So there you are.
Wow,
that's it.
we're getting to really unpack.
That's
you
a biggie.
Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah,
that's a big one.
Since then, in my mind, you almost look at sort of two major achievements, the master's, and now launching all of this, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But, you know, how much do you feel like that path was kind of getting set in, you know, as you were coming out of that?
I think what ended up happening was I actually tried to force things and I wasn't ready for them at a much earlier phase. So I was juggling at one point the babies, my recovery, and I thought it would be a good idea to open my own consultancy firm.
Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. At the time, I felt it was important because I felt I needed something for myself. But looking back, I think it was too soon. And then I had this hiatus of a year or so. And I remember my husband saying to me, if you don't do something, I mean, you can't just sit around. you're going to go nuts and you're going to drive me nuts.
Right.
So I thought, okay, he's right. I do have to do something. And I wasn't quite sure yet what direction I wanted to go in. And so I turned my thinking towards going back to college. And so I enrolled at AUC and I did a master's in global affairs. And I did it part-time, so it took me 3.5 years, but it was amazing. It was a great experience. And the idea of going twice a week in the evenings to class, meeting professors, meeting students, something that was just for me, and timing-wise, I could control it.
As you mentioned, in a way, it kind of reactivated you almost.
Exactly.
And put you back in the places you wanted to be.
Exactly. Yeah. It did, very much so. And then my last few months of the degree, I had wanted to start a podcast earlier, and it had always been in my mind for a while I was doing my studies. But I knew I couldn't juggle both.
Wait, when did you complete your master's? Was it in 2020, right?
And 2020,
yeah. You started in 2017, basically.
Exactly.
Roughly. So I'm gonna tell you something that's really like almost like a very interesting thing, right? Because three of your pivot years are 2001, 2007, and 2017.
Okay.
Yeah, and in 2001 was when I left the UAE for the first time when I went to the US.
Yeah.
In 2007, against my will, I came back to Dubai. So that's one of my pivot points, by the way. And 2017 is when I started all this.
That's so funny, Chirag.
Yeah, it's literally the same year.
We married each other, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We were going through shifts at the same time, which I think is just because...
That's interesting.
Yeah, when you mentioned the second year, I was kind of like, okay, that's a little bit of a coincidence, but we're going to move on.
Yeah.
And then that's why I clarified when you said like, I was kind of like, wait, so 3 years ago was 2017. 2017
that's
is
so
when
funny.
When I made the really like the actual move to be like, no, that's it. I'm going to start a podcast company, even if it's going to take a little while.
That is funny.
How about that?
We'll have to coordinate our next pivots for Chirag, you and I.
Let's do it. Yeah. This time let's do it with a little bit of planning, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so
so let's get into the other question, which is, of course, we want to talk about sort of the inspirational sort of books and movies, but I want to add a twist to that, which is podcasts, because I think we should find out what kind of podcasts you like. And maybe,
of course,
I have an inkling of what the movie might be, and I think listeners may also, but let's ask you about the movie first.
Actually, really, you have an inkling? I have three movies. Can I talk about three movies?
I was gonna say, like, of course you can. Then I'm like, well, it's your show. Of course you can do whatever you want.
So actually, one of my films and one of my books is the same.
Okay.
So it's Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton. She's an American writer who wrote in the early 1900s. And it was turned into a film with Daniel Day-Lewis, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Winona Ryder. But the most amazing thing for me about the film, the book is incredible. She writes beautifully. But the film was directed by someone who is better known for gangster flicks. So it was directed by Martin Scorsese. And apparently he did it because he wanted his father to know that he could direct a thing of beauty as opposed to a thing of violence.
Wow, okay. That's really interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah, and he did it so wonderfully that you'd never guess that it was him if you had only ever seen his other work before.
Correct, of course, yeah.
And then I think the one you're thinking of is The Godfather.
Absolutely.
Because I've mentioned it in many interviews. Exactly. So the trilogy, I like all three. And I know that the third one gets panned a lot, but I do like all three. And so that's Francis Ford Coppola, who directed that. My third film, if you allow me, is the first film by his daughter, Sophia, which is Lost in Translation. That is, for me, one of my all-time favorites. And has now made me want to go to Japan. I'm dying to visit Japan. And it's primarily because of that film.
Movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just so ethereal and so of another time and space almost. So those are my movies. But I would like to mention a TV show, which for people who know me is almost more important than these, which is The West Wing.
Oh, really? I'm almost not surprised now, but you know.
Yeah, exactly. So The West Wing, I watched it religiously when it came out.
Of the show, yeah.
Are you?
It was my COVID watch.
Yeah, well, I actually rewatched it last year.
It was, honestly, to watch that show in 2020 was its own kind of eye-opener for me. Aaron Sorkin can go up and down, but I think the way he writes dialogue is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah,
like, there's no question, right? So for me, even The Newsroom...
Yeah, I love The Newsroom.
Kind of went in a lot of different directions eventually, and it's fine. But that first season and the first few episodes, because I know that he would have written the dialogue for most of those.
Yeah.
All the walking and talking style.
He's brilliant.
And you see his imprint all over it and the way it's written. But it's of course, it goes more than that. It's all the relationships, it's all the diplomacy, it's all of it, which,
yeah,
you know, almost like is kind of, you know, one of those history repeat itself kind of feelings when you watch it. And then when I was watching in 2020, that was my realization.
The funny thing is, because I read a lot of biographies by ex-Obama staffers.
Yeah.
And a lot of them modeled themselves on the West Wing
characters. On the characters of the West Wing. Okay.
Which is very disturbing
is that art imitates life imitates
exactly.
art kind of thing, right?
Exactly. Oh, exactly. And
that is not a happy
thought. Jed Bartlett is the president we all want, you know?
Yeah, I think it's a great show. We've done the movie, the TV. We've hit one book. Let's go further.
I have another fiction book, but it's very similar to the other one, which is Henry James, Portrait of a Lady. It's a similar genre. And then my two nonfiction books. So one is called Cairo, City Victorious by Max Rodenbeck. And this is a fantastic history of Cairo. And I think I've read it maybe 3 or 4 times over the years. My other book is actually a book very few people would know. It's called Personal History.
Okay.
And it's by a woman called Catherine Graham. It's an autobiography. And she is she was the publisher, the owner and publisher of the Washington Post. Her father was the owner. And when her father died, her husband took over he became publisher. And then her husband committed suicide and she took the reins of the publication.
Right. Okay.
And she was a very traditional housewifey sort of person. She was, you know, more comfortable being the hostess at large dinners and so on. And she became the publisher at a time where the newspaper was very much in the news itself. So the first major thing was the Pentagon Papers, which was a really big deal at the time.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they're the newspaper that broke the Watergate scandal. And it was on her watch that happened.
Yeah.
And her story is just amazing because she obviously talks about these really important points in history, or at least history of the U.S. And that's a book I've read a couple of times and it's really stayed with me.
Wow, that was an interesting choice. I like that.
Yeah. It's worth picking up if you can find it.
Right. No, definitely will. I think we have music left.
So here, Chirag, I mean, I don't have like a favorite and I don't think anyone can pick a favorite. Even our guests never were able to pick one.
You can't say that now because now you're giving all the future guests a free pass to be like, well, if you couldn't pick a favorite, why are you making me pick one?
I basically made a list of all the music I like and I listen to music depending on my mood, you know, it depends.
Of course.
So I've written down here, I like Prince, I like the Eagles, I like George Michael, I like Frank Sinatra, Eric Clapton, Fleetwood Mac, INXS, if you remember them, Simon and Garfunkel, Bob Marley, Rolling Stones. I mean, you know, I like artists that where there are proper lyrics, where there's a story, where, you know.
I was gonna say, like, I feel like that's a little bit of shade against like the more recent musicians, but
we won't get into that. I'm throwing shade on it. I mean, I will admit to you, I am. And if my son can hear me now, he'd flip, because all we hear from his room is like heavy duty rap. But you know,
fair enough.
My musical taste has sort of not evolved. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, we had. I think this was with Ali, right?
Omar Samra.
Was it Omar Samra? Maybe. Okay, where he said, like, you know, my musical choices are stuck in the 90s and
exactly. Well, mine like started in the 70s and moved
slightly
forward
earlier, but still.
They don't go past the 90s mine, so yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about podcasts. I mean, I want to kind of continue on from this question, which is like, you know, do you have maybe a couple of podcasts or some favorites that you're enjoying listening to?
Sure. So firstly, I'm a news junkie. So I consume a lot of news and I'm always like looking at different newspapers online and so on. So I started off by listening to podcasts that were affiliated with newspapers.
Okay.
And I still do to a large extent. So I listen to The Guardian. I listen to The Times has a good one. Obviously, the New York Times as well. Yeah. And then I love there's a company called Intelligence Squared. They run debates, and they do them. They used to do them in person in the UK before the pandemic, and they also have one a US version. Then there's one called Talking Politics, which yeah. is done in affiliation with the London Review of Books. It's hosted by a guy called David Runciman, who's a professor at Oxford. Or Cambridge, I forget which one. And he's absolutely brilliant. These are, you know, podcasts for me are always about where am I listening to it. His podcasts I'll listen to if I'm going for a long walk, for example. Then I love history. So I listen to a lot of history podcasts. There's a couple in the BBC group. So there's one called In Our Time. And then there is History Hits. There's a few of them. My only concern with the history podcasts that I've found, they're very Western centric.
Yes.
I like the Axe Files.
We spoke about this show, I remember, in the beginning. Yeah.
Yeah. He's an ex, he was the campaign manager for Obama, I think, in the first campaign. Yeah. And then he worked at the White House with him. And then I like the New Yorker podcasts. But I find also they're a little bit, they're almost becoming a bit of a caricature of what a left liberal should be talking about, you know, and it's almost, you can almost predict what they're going to say.
You've literally given us the quote of the episode, I think, there, but anyway.
Yeah, but you know, I like to keep my I'm equal opportunities with my political views, so I do listen to the right wing and I listen to the left wing, so I don't really tend to go for a political point of view. I tend to go for the story that's being told.
Yeah.
And I kind of like it when I listen to something that I don't agree with.
No, I think it's healthy, and I think we are finding our at least a lot of the conversations we're having are tend to be very siloed ultimately.
But you know, Chirag, one of my new pet peeves that has been I've been reading so much about, and I've been mentioning it in a few of our episodes with the guests, is this concept of cancel culture, where, you know, if you don't agree with what I say, then I'm just going to eliminate you from any discussion. And I just find, you know, it's becoming more and more prevalent in the US, in the UK.
It's just become an easy way out. I think people just...
Yeah.
And more so after last year, people feel like they don't have the bandwidth for anything. And then that, it unfortunately, is being translated to, now I don't have the bandwidth to actually debate you, so I'm out. And I understand where that comes from as a sentiment, but I think it's extremely unhealthy.
I worry for my children's generation as well about that. Yeah. You know, they're going to go to college. My eldest is going to college in a couple of years, and he's going to get to college and he's going to be confronted by people who just don't know how to communicate with each other.
Correct.
And, you know, they're like, you know, don't talk to me about that. I will not discuss that with you. Or this whole snowflake generation thing is really freaky.
So I want to kind of close out, like, just talking a little bit about sort of what you're doing next. Let's talk a little bit about A&T Media and kind of what you've been thinking about and what you're thinking towards.
So you mentioned A&T Media. So A&T Media is sort of like my overall holding or umbrella company, whereby I'm hoping to launch other podcasts, as you know, of different varieties, different subjects. But the one thing they all have in common is that they would be podcasts that are geared to Middle Easterners or people in the region. So that's the ethos running through the entire concept. The different podcasts that I'm thinking of launching, I don't really want to go into right now because I'm still working on their directions.
Yeah.
Exactly. But they're very different to the current one. I think for now that's, you know, that's pretty much all I'll say, and just sort of say, watch this space or keep listening kind of thing, you know?
I think one of the ideas, and I know it drives you too, is sort of when you're talking about the Middle East and stuff, is bringing that perspective to the table, providing that insight, shining that light on things that are happening here that are not just politically relevant, but just generally relevant society-wise and otherwise, right? I mean, when you look at what season one of What I Did Next was, yes, it was in some ways a way to establish, you know, what you wanted to do and starting a podcast. And that's why we said, we'll pick up one, we'll kind of run through it through the season and see where we go from there. And I think to some degree, now that we are kind of sitting back and being able to look back at the season, that focus, I think, has played a part in its reception, right? Of course, we had incredible guests. who shared incredible aspects about their lives, that some of which that, you know, they haven't openly shared elsewhere. In some cases, they didn't get into that kind of detail or whatever be the reason. But I think they're all incredible people, of course. But I think that plays a part. And I think that that is sort of almost a guiding mission. I know it is for me, but I think as well for you.
For me, I think what I did next works primarily because I've been able to select guests who have a really interesting story. At the end of the day, it's about the story. It's almost irrelevant what they do, what their profession is. It's almost irrelevant. It's how they communicate their story and the authenticity of it. Because I think you can feel immediately when someone is has said their story many times and has almost got a script going, you know, or versus the type or versus the guest who is really thinking about each question and giving you a really honest answer. And I think we've been very lucky with our guests that, you know, they've really been very upfront and very open about their lives. And that's what makes a, you know, an interesting story. As a listener, that's what I want
to
hear.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, to some extent, we have to also, it's also, you know, your credit as an interviewer as well, right? I think there's a little doubt in my mind, at least, in that, like, all of those experiences, all of your pivot points kind of coming together, your own personal interest, of course, as you mentioned, I mean, in terms of journalism and everything else around it, presenting, you know, your perspective on the table. And I, you know, there's been many episodes where that's happened, right? Where you've brought in or you've added a perspective that, you know, I think the guests are able to also relate to that. So they feel comfortable doing that. And it's a major part of it, by the way.
I think so.
It absolutely is. Yeah.
Sure. I mean, I think the challenges I've faced in my life have made me much more empathetic to the nuances in people's lives, you know, and that's definitely, that plays a part. I don't know if I'd have been able to do this podcast, you know, 15 years ago. You know, there are levels of experience now that definitely play a role in how I interview and what I do. You know, I used to do interviews when I was working on one of the magazines in London, but I was young and I was, you know, inexperienced and it was fun, but it could have been a lot more exciting. It was just very formulaic, but that was also part of the style they wanted at the time. But you know, definitely being older and having had challenges allows me to maybe ask the question that is almost going unasked, you know, like the hidden question, or read between the lines a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, I think the perspective definitely changes that. Yeah, for sure. I think this is a great point to end, because it ties us back to the Steve Jobs interview, right? And sort of talking about connecting the dots backwards. You know, there was a point where, you know, when you were talking about what you're doing now in the masters and everything else, and you said, you know, I tried to force myself to start a consulting firm and whatever, and you were like, it didn't work for me. It wasn't the right time, and you were able to say that today. But again, it's always, you know, in hindsight, you can look back and connect the dots, which is exactly what the point of that speech was. And so, you know, don't worry about them today. Start moving in the direction. I think that that's kind of a nice little ribbon that we can tie.
Yeah, no, you're right.
You know,
no, definitely.
Yeah. So I think, you know, we want to say a big, big thank you to every single person that's listening and has listened to every episode of What I Did Next. This entire season and all the support, the reviews, it's honestly, it has been fantastic. I mean, it's been great to be at the receiving end of all that, and we're very excited for season two, I think. So
definitely. No, I'm also, I was not sure about doing this little interview, whether that would be a great idea, but I deferred to your better knowledge on this. But it was good. I'm happy we did it. It's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, because no one knew who I was going into this at the beginning of the season. And, you know, I guess as with each episode, maybe people get to know me a little bit more. But now, you know, they've got the full picture.
Yes, exactly.
In closing, I just want to let you know that a great season 2 is already in the works. There's an amazing lineup of guests coming your way in a couple of months' time. I'm delighted that I'll be welcoming people from across the Middle East, as well as across a variety of industries and sectors. Each person has an incredible story, and each one shows us how pivots and shifts in their lives have allowed them to connect the dots. While we're on hiatus, please stay tuned to our Instagram page, where you'll get bonus material and funny outtakes from season one and news on what's coming next. Thank you for joining us on this episode of What I Did Next, brought to you by ANT Media with me, Malek Fouad, and co-produced by Chirag Desai. I look forward to welcoming you back in a couple of months' time.